DW Deutsche Welle. World in Progress.
Today on the show, how the elders help to shape the future with experience and charisma.
Basically, these are people that have dedicated their lives to promoting human rights and peace and sustainable development, that know a lot about how change happens and how to help driving change.
Also on World in Progress, Afro-Colombians still face discrimination.
In Cartagena and on the coast, there's a lot of discrimination. Despite the fact that nearly everyone here is of an Afro-Colombian background, there's still racism, even places we can't go.
And keeping ancient storytelling alive in India.
I keep telling my daughter not to stop this tradition of telling stories. It's important for her children to keep it going.
Stay tuned. Hello and welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn. Headline news is often made by politicians, activists and public officials holding key offices. But once they step down, many are quickly forgotten, while some remain highly respected. There's a very special group of such people who are known as the elders. They're mainly elder statesmen and women who have joined together to work for world peace and human rights. Learning the lessons of history is very much a part of what they're striving for. And they're a pretty notable bunch. Nelson Mandela is their symbolic head. The group also consists of people like former US President Jimmy Carter, South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu, former Irish President Mary Robinson and Kofi Annan, who used to head the United Nations. But apart from making great speeches and holding conferences between elders and youngers about new ways of doing things, are these retired leaders really making any difference? Ashley Byrne has more on the work of the elders for World in Progress.
The efforts of a small, dedicated group of leaders, working objectively and without any vested personal interest in the outcome, can help resolve what often seems like intractable problems.
Nelson Mandela there announcing the formation of the elders on his 89th birthday in 2007. Chaired by Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the Elders is an independent group of global leaders who work together for peace and human rights. They believe that in any conflict, it is important to listen to everyone, no matter how unpalatable or unpopular this might be. But how did the organisation come about? Leslie Ann Knight is the Chief Executive Officer of the Elders Foundation.
On the release of Nelson Mandela and him taking on the presidency of South Africa, he had this yearning to pull together a group of elder statesmen and elder stateswomen, but people who around the world at a global level could inspire and motivate and set alight others.
Amongst the elders is former UN General Secretary Kofi Annan, the first woman president of Ireland, Mary Robinson, former US President Jimmy Carter, and the first female Prime Minister of Norway, Gro Harlem Brundtland.
You have to build consensus around values, around perspectives, around where we are going, what vision we should have for the future. And so in many ways, working with people who are on the same page, basically, and trying to together to try to address intractable, difficult issues in the best possible way.
The elders operate through persuasion and diplomacy and have none of the power that they enjoyed in their former careers. So does this lead to a frustration at not being able to get things done sometimes?
I think frustration is very much a kind of an agenda of people in a hurry or people with great ambitions.
Leslie Ann Knight again.
I don't think that's the place the elders are now in. When, as President Carter, you've got to turning 89 this year and you're still up and running and you're constantly on the road, frustration is not something that's going to stop you easily.
I think for the first time in my memory of the Mideast peace process, we have reached a crisis stage because all the previous prime ministers of Israel have been committed to a two-state solution. That policy of promoting a two-state solution seems to be abandoned now. And we are deeply concerned about this move toward a catastrophic so-called first one-state choice. It's not a solution, it's a choice.
President Jimmy Carter there giving an independent viewpoint on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. In June 2012, world leaders came together for Rio Plus 20, the UN Conference on Sustainable Development. 3 months earlier, the elders launched Elders and Youngers, a series of debates with leading climate change activists who are committed to putting sustainable development into practice and working to make sure that young people's concerns are represented at a global level. Pedro Telles is one of those youngers.
Basically, these are people that have dedicated their lives to promoting human rights and peace and sustainable development, that know a lot about how change happens and how to help driving change. And they didn't really have the chance to work together in a sense that the elders allow while they were presidents. And now they have the chance of working together in this multicultural environment. It's a huge potential for driving change and for empowering others to drive change.
And that empowerment didn't stop at Rio. Former Norwegian Prime Minister Gro Harlem Brundtland again.
Well, we should continue linking up on this issue, sustainable development, which is where the recruitment came from and the intentions of collaboration came from, but also linking up with young people in other critical issues of our times and of our future, yes.
If we're looking at a situation where peace has broken down, this could be, say, the resurgence now of some of the violence in Northern Ireland, for example.
Chief Executive Officer of the Elders Foundation, Leslie Ann Knight again.
Just bringing a group of young people, representative of youth and young people, student bodies, civil society in Northern Ireland, to sit around the table with the elders. And first and foremost, for the elders to say to them, we want to listen to what you're living through, I think makes a huge difference to younger people, because they know who's sitting opposite them. And for then there to be simply a dialogue and exchange of, well, maybe you could do this, have you tried this? Even though it was 20 or 30 years ago, this is what worked for me.
Since their formation in 2007, the elders have worked to stop child marriage, support the Middle East peace process, and taken a stand on issues concerning the Korean Peninsula, Syria and Sudan. They work quietly, without huge noise and razzmatazz, but their independent voice continues to be heard on the ground. And through the Youngers and the Elders Project, their experience is being shared with other generations. Let's leave the last word to their founder and honorary elder, Nelson Mandela.
This group derives its strength not from political, economic or military power, but from the independence and integrity of those who are here. I have watched the concept grow and become a real, viable and pragmatic initiative.
This is Ashley Byrne for DW in London.
The murder of a leading Afro-Colombian human rights campaigner at the end of last year continues to throw the spotlight on the country's often overlooked black community. Colombia has one of the largest populations of people of African descent in Latin America. Nevertheless, discrimination is a huge problem. DW's Nick Davis has this report from Cartagena, which is home to the country's biggest community of black people.
Watching the sunset over the Caribbean Sea at Café Del Mar is one of the things to do in Cartagena. The old Spanish walled city, with its battlements to protect from attacks by the English, evoke the country's colonial past. The whole place was built on the labour of enslaved Africans, whose descendants make up most of the population in the area. Despite many Afro-Colombians having fought for the nation's independence in the 1810 uprising against the Spanish, it wasn't until 1851 that slavery was abolished. Even today, prejudices remain, as I soon discovered talking to people in the street.
In Cartagena and on the coast, there's a lot of discrimination. People really see race. Despite the fact that nearly everyone here is of an Afro-Colombian background, there's still racism, even places we can't go.
People of African descent make up 11% of the Colombian population, and in Cartagena, nearly a quarter of the population class themselves as Afro-Colombian. That's over 300,000 people. But according to census data, they suffer higher unemployment rates and lower success in school than other ethnic groups in Colombia. But things are improving in some communities, such as Isla Grande, an island just off the coast. On the tourist boat Isla Grande on the Caribbean side, the guides are introducing the boat crew for the hour-long ride.
And our captain, nuestro capitán allá arriba, el señor Vicente. Un aplauso para el capitán. Mírenlo allá.
The majority of islanders are Afro-Colombian, and although their families have lived here for hundreds of years, they lack the papers proving that they are indeed related to the original inhabitants. A law passed in the early 90s gave them the right of collective titles, but many never knew, and the government tried to evict some residents in favour of developers planning to build luxury condominiums on the island. But eventually, the election of a new reform-friendly government in 2010 ushered in a new period of hope for Afro-Colombians. The island is small. It has a church, a shop, and that's it. The shop belongs to Herman Caballo, who is of Afro-Colombian descent and is proud that they now own their land.
Now we have the opportunity to own the land on the island we live on. At the beginning, they tried to kick us off because it was a wasteland, as they called it, and it belonged to the government. But now they've allowed us to be guardians of the island. They approved because the land belonged to our ancestors.
At last year's Summit of the Americas in Colombia, US President Obama joined with President Santos and the singer Shakira to present land titles to people in Cartagena.
Today is an important first step.
It's a small step but deeply symbolic, especially for the Afro-Colombian communities like the one on Isla Grande, who receive the papers of collective ownership shortly after. However, the government's concessions towards the Afro-Colombian community has been met with violence in other parts of the country by landowners who illegally took land during more than 20 years of fighting between guerrillas, paramilitaries and the government. Those displaced have been campaigning to get back their property, and more than 10 Afro-Colombian activists have been murdered in the past 3 years. The most recent killing was in December 2012. The Afro-Colombian land rights activist Miller Angulo Riviera was shot dead in the coastal town of Tumaco. His death sent ripples through Afro-Colombian communities all across the country, says Isla Grande community organiser Ana Rosa.
Con eso,
we went to Cartagena and protested in front of the council building for our rights. No more violence. We don't want anybody to die. We want the process to continue without death, without any of this.
Tensions are still high in Afro-Colombian communities across the country. They know the fight for restitution will be long, with over 30,000 cases still to be heard in the courts, and only 16 rulings have been made so far. But slowly progress is being made, and every win is a step forward, says Ana.
We are 360 families, and we're no longer afraid now that we have our titles. Together we have strength.
The islands continue to depend on tourism for their survival, but now the people who live here have a stake in their own future. They own their own land, and despite being away from the mainland, they feel as if they're finally getting equality in their own country.
Nick Davis there, reporting from Colombia. And as always, you can find all these and many other reports on human rights, development and globalization issues on our webpage at dw.de/globalization. And that's globalization spelled with a Z. Still to come on World in Progress, a report about keeping alive the ancient storytelling tradition in India. But first, Connor Dillon is taking a peek at some development news.
Syria cuts internet connections. Internet connections between Syria and the outside world were cut off on Tuesday, according to data from Google and other global internet companies. Google says access to its own pages was blocked for a period of several hours. The vast majority of websites within Syria were rendered unreachable as well, other experts said, as the country appeared to shut itself off. We've seen this twice before, said Christine Chen, Google's senior manager for free expression. This happened in Syria last November and in Egypt during the Arab Spring. UN warns of nearly 13,000 displaced families in northern Pakistan, with numbers rising. The United Nations Emergency Relief Arm warned that population displacement could surge once more due to government military operations and ongoing fighting between armed groups in northern Pakistan, near the Afghan border. Nearly 76,000 people have been displaced in the Tira Valley, in North Pakistan's federally administered tribal areas since mid-March, said Jens Lerka, a spokesperson from the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. The UN estimates that the number of refugees from the conflict area would likely double soon. The displaced people may remain homeless for up to 6 months due to the high insecurity. While basic assistance is already provided, more than $25 million US dollars will be needed to adequately address the needs of the displaced. Displacement from Pakistan's tribal areas began in 2008, in the wake of a government crackdown on insurgents. Guinea paramilitary officer charged for involvement in massacre. A Guinean paramilitary police officer has been slapped with the first rape charges in the 2009 Conakry Stadium massacre, during which at least 157 protesters were killed. The International Federation for Human Rights welcomed the move as a strong signal that justice could finally be served to the more than 100 women raped during that tragedy. Tens of thousands of people had gathered in the stadium to protest against the junta led by Moussa Dadis Camara. Security forces opened fire and mowed down the protesters, killing at least 157. Hundreds were wounded and dozens are still missing. A special panel of judges has been set up to investigate the massacre. Six members of the Guinean military have been charged thus far, but the trials have yet to begin. Venezuela to use its military to fight crime. The government of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro is planning to use the military to fight rampant violent crime in Venezuela. The announcement made on Sunday is raising concerns among activists, who warned the initiative could lead to human rights violations. Venezuela's Justice Minister, Miguel Rodriguez, said personnel from the Army, Navy, and Air Force will join National Guard troops as part of a forthcoming anti-crime initiative. According to a recently released study by the UN Development Program, Venezuela had the world's fifth highest homicide rate last year, trailing Honduras, El Salvador, the Ivory Coast, and Jamaica. Human rights groups like Provea have warned against using armed forces to fight crime because military personnel are not trained for such duties. Peruvian official protests cutting back indigenous rights. A key Peruvian official tasked with implementing a law that will give indigenous groups more rights has resigned to protest efforts by President Ollanta Humala's cabinet to roll back that law to protect mining investments. Deputy Culture Minister Ivan La Negra was upset that the government had decided to exclude Quechua-speaking communities in the mineral-rich Andes Mountains from being covered by Peru's prior consultation law. That law gives indigenous communities the right to shape natural resource developments that affect them, but does not allow them to veto projects. Mining companies in Peru, which is one of the world's top mineral exporters, are worried that the law would slow new projects by making community approvals more difficult. The government is now arguing that Quechua communities in the Andes are not indigenous, but instead peasant. When he signed the law in 2011, President Humala had listed the Quechua as one of the indigenous groups that would be covered by the law to, quote, build a great republic that respects all its nationalities. Deadliest month in Iraq in 5 years. In April, more people were killed and wounded in violent attacks across Iraq than in any month since June 2008. According to UN figures, a total of 712 people were killed and 1,633 wounded in acts of terrorism and violence. The majority of victims were civilians, with 595 civilians killed and 1,438 injured. Baghdad was the worst affected governorate. The special representative of the UN Secretary General in Iraq, Martin Kobler, has repeatedly called on Iraqi authorities to take decisive measures to stop the escalating violence.
That was Connor Dillon with the development news. India has always had a rich culture of storytelling. From well-known national epics like the Mahabharata to local village folklore, stories have been passed down orally from generation to generation. Each region of the country has its own set of stories and also a special tradition of storytelling. Some villages in South India, for example, have a tradition of telling stories through song. Yet these age-old customs and traditions are slowly dying out. With rapid urbanization and globalization, other media are now increasingly replacing ancient forms of storytelling. So is there a place for the old traditions in times of TV and Twitter? Pia Chandavakar visited some storytellers in southern India to find out.
The elementary school at the village of Panayakottai in the south Indian state of Tamil Nadu is abuzz with activity. The school children swarm excitedly around the visitors who have come from the city of Chennai. In one corner of the schoolyard, a group of ladies sit quietly, waiting. They have been invited to share some stories with a group of folklore experts and storytellers from Chennai, who are here to study their unique style of narration. One of these ladies is 80-year-old Ayamma. Dressed in a white sari, her silver hair cropped short, Ayamma is an energetic and enthusiastic storyteller, her quivering voice full of passion. The school children and visitors gathered in the courtyard listen intently as Ayamma narrates the epic of the honest king Harishchandra, who leaves behind his kingdom, wealth and family to keep his word to a holy sage whom he had angered. For some parts of the story, like when one of the characters speaks, Ayamma breaks into song. Ayamma's style of narration with singing is called Kadayum Patum, or story and song. It's an ancient art of storytelling traditionally practiced in some villages in the southern Indian state of Tamil Nadu. These folk tales are often about kings and queens, brave hunters or clever animals. They often include moral advice, like avoiding lies or theft, never being greedy, and so on. There are many different stories, and each village has its own versions. Traditionally, parents and grandparents narrated or sang these stories to their children and grandchildren at home. This style is also common in theatrical plays. Ayamma first heard the story of King Harishchandra in one such play, staged at her village many years ago. She says she enjoyed it so much that she often sang the songs to herself. Nowadays, she says, those kind of plays are rarely performed.
You can't tell these kinds of stories anymore. I tell my grandchildren stories at home, but they find these old ones too boring. They only like the funny ones, like stories of a naughty rat.
52-year-old Jnanasundari also has trouble getting her 5-year-old grandson to listen to her stories. Her daughter's family lives in a nearby town, so she doesn't get to spend much time with him. When they visit, she says, she sings lullabies to him at night. But the rest of the day, he only wants to watch TV and doesn't listen to stories.
I keep telling my daughter not to stop this tradition of telling stories. It's important for her children to keep it going. If they get used to hearing lullabies and songs at a small age, their listening skills will develop. Otherwise, they'll never take an interest.
Jnanasundari says she has written down all the stories and songs she knows for her daughter, hoping the future generation will keep them alive. Bhanumati is 35. Married at just 13, she never forgot the stories and folk songs her father taught her when she was a child. Bhanumati's story is a local village legend of 7 virgin goddesses bathing in the temple pond who come across a jewelry vendor. Yet, Bhanumati says, her enthusiasm for these stories is not shared by her 3 grown children, ranging from 15 to 20 in age.
I tell my children the stories because I think it's important, but they just ridicule me, saying they don't want to hear these boring stories from my time or my parents' time.
Bhanumati's experience reflects a reality that is fast spreading throughout India. With satellite television making its way even to the most remote villages, TV shows and soap operas are increasingly replacing traditional modes of storytelling. As more young people migrate to larger towns and cities to study or work, local village traditions are sidelined further.
Small kids may be interested in such storytelling performances, but I don't think young people attend them. I've never been to one myself, so I don't really know.
If it's narrated like an ordinary lesson, then we'll obviously not find it interesting. It has to be made attractive, with pictures and stuff.
Many young people, both in urban and rural setting, feel out of tune with the ancient storytelling tradition.
Our generation is not interested in listening to stories, would rather go to the movies. Stories like Ramayana and Mahabharata are for the older generation.
The values these stories teach are definitely useful to today's generation. If we just read it in books or on the internet, we can't really apply those values in life. If our relatives or elders explain it to us, then we will absorb them better.
You can have shows on TV where these stories are narrated. Then there's a chance that these old traditions and culture can be revived.
Ancient forms of storytelling today remain confined mostly within villages and to ethnologists and scholars who study them. Folklore expert Eric Miller led the group of visitors from the city of Chennai to Panayakottai as part of an effort to increase awareness about these storytelling forms. Miller says traditional storytelling is still relevant in today's world as a group learning technique, where the storyteller helps the listeners identify with the story.
As the story goes on, the characters of the story can be superimposed onto the people at the storytelling event. And it's very interesting and fun. And then if they have a discussion afterwards about what the whole thing was about, it really gets people thinking and feeling. That kind of activity is very enriching intellectually, emotionally, and I think most people who do it enjoy it.
Miller teaches storytelling techniques to a wide range of people, including college students and businessmen. Traditional forms of storytelling are now being adapted for various fields like corporate training, language and phonetic skills, and even as a counseling technique. Pia Chandavarkar, DW, Panayakottai, India.
And this report wraps up today's edition of World in Progress. Thanks for tuning in today. We'll be back with a fresh edition next week at the same time. Till then, you can listen back to these stories and read many other reports on human rights and development online. Just go to our webpage at dw.de/globalization, and that's globalization spelled with a Z. For today, on behalf of the studio team Eliane Giaducci and Gerd Georgi, I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn saying thanks for listening and goodbye.